Stay tuned for Occupied Territory, hosted by Mike Fader. And this is Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. Don't forget, we have a companion Facebook page for this show. Everything, almost everything that you hear on this show, articles I refer to are posted. And I write essays, rants, whatever, pleas for justice, and other people respond on the Facebook page. So Google Facebook and Occupied Territory, and it will take you to that page. If you are so moved, you can like it. Although Facebook, I don't know. I was watching TV the other night, and there was some dancing oranges on for some orange juice company, and it told me if I wanted to, I could like the company that made orange juice. Or when I'm looking at Facebook, it says, it's suggested, or whatever the phraseology is, that you like the demonstration in Wyoming to save the red-tailed field mouse. Really? I like all this stuff, but anyhow, apparently it's a mark of popularity. It used to be on, there was only one thing on the radio and TV called the Nielsen ratings. If you go back all the way, do they still have Nielsen ratings? I guess they do. But if you broadcast on internet radio, it's likes is one of the things that where people can tell that people are listening and that it has some impact. And it's easier for me to track guests, for instance, or higher-level guests, quote-unquote higher-level, if I get more likes. So if you go to Occupied Territory Facebook page, just click like. Unless, you're afraid of being on some list of radical sympathizers, then don't do it. Protect yourself at all times. So there's that. Also, if you want to get in touch with me, you could do it through there, but it's public, of course. And if you want to get in touch with me about anything that's not public, go to my website, Fader Files, FederFiles.com. And you can join up, sign a mailing list. I send out, I post essays on there and send out notes and references and other expressions of interest to the mailing list on a fairly regular basis. And you can see what else I do on the radio. So those two things, but especially Occupied Territory, the Facebook page. Last week was the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq. Not that you would ever know it if you paid attention to the leaders of this country, i.e. the people who actually got us into the war in Iraq and the people who presided over, invasion, occupation, and ultimately withdrawal from the war of Iraq. But war in Iraq. It started around 10 years ago. As we all know now, although nobody's gone to jail for it because they're too high up in the world, and that would be terrible to see the ex-president and the vice president and the former head of the NSA and the secretary of state and the joint chiefs of staff and everybody doing hard labor, which is what they should be doing for 50 years, rest of their unnatural lives. However, that's not going to happen because they changed the entire course of world history. Helped to destroy the economies of most countries in the world, especially ours, and caused the deaths of, estimates are very wide-ranging, anywhere from 20, 30, 50, 60, 70,000 people, and I'm talking about civilians in this case, to over a million people. And that includes American casualties and deaths and woundings, people who come back to this country with their brains and their bodies destroyed who did come back. And maybe people estimate close to a million Iraqis from the disruption of facilities, from basic health, lack of basic health care, from actual explosions, from suicide bombings, from all the turbulence and difficulty that occurred, and especially from American use of various weapons, one of which was depleted uranium, which we'll get to in a minute. Of course, we would use depleted uranium weapons. They're only just WOGs. You know, they're darkies. What do we care what we do to them? You know, just like the Japs, the gooks. So anyhow, 10 years. Now, last week, on the very day of the 10th anniversary, and you're dealing, like, again, you're dealing with something that killed, what was it, several thousand American soldiers died over there on a lie, on a vicious, immoral, deliberate lie. Several thousand American soldiers died. Tens of thousands came back wounded, without legs, without arms, who died soon afterwards, who lost their minds, who still can't deal with regular life, who commit murder and domestic abuse and suicide. There's a suicide almost every day among veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. Almost every day there is a suicide. And in Iraq, an entire country almost completely destroyed. Corruption, buildings, thousands of buildings toppled to the ground, explosions, bombs dropped indiscriminately, drone strikes, you name it. Helicopters, we saw what Bradley Manning released. The first thing that grabbed the world's attention that he released as a classified document was the video taken from a United States Army attack helicopter that deliberately slaughtered civilians. And when people came to help them, people shot down in the street, they shot those people down too, giggled all the time like they were playing a video game. So this is what happened in Iraq. One of the great stains on the history of this entire country, and there's some pretty bad stains on the history of this country. 10th anniversary last week, the President of the United States made a couple of speeches about this, that, and the other. He had a press conference. Didn't say one word about it. Nothing. Like it never happened. Now, I wonder how that feels. He did make actually a couple of references to current events. One was that he was going to wear green in his, I don't know what, on his jock strap for St. Patrick's Day, whatever the president said. He was going to wear green on some part of himself. And he made a joke about some other thing that was happening with golfing or something. Didn't say a word. The President of the United States, who presided at the moment, he helped, presided over the withdrawal of troops. They're not all gone, by the way. We have something called the Green Zone over there. You take a good look and see how many mercenaries and U.S. Special Ops people and CIA people are still in the Green Zone, right smack in the middle of Baghdad, half running things there. And if they're not running things, half spying and making sure things go the right way for whatever we call American interests. 10 years, not a mention of it by our leaders, not a mention of it by the people who committed this crime. They didn't recall that it was a brave day in American history. Anything from Bush, from Cheney, from Powell, from Rice, from all of these people, from Donald Rumsfeld, who was one of the chief criminals, of course, too. I forgot him before. Not one word from these war criminals. Not one word. To celebrate our great victory over there. Mission accomplished, right? Talk to the average Iraqi, if the choice between Saddam Hussein and the American invasion and what was unleashed after that, I have no idea. I don't live there. But as a result, over a million people have either been killed, have been permanently wounded, or have actually disappeared over borders and into refugee camps, their lives ruined. We have destroyed practically an entire country. Who knows what will become of it? What is becoming of it now is there's a new bombing or 5 bombings or 10 bombings every day. I don't know if it'll work out. But nothing, not a word. And I'm wondering, how does that feel if you're a veteran of the Iraq War? If you went over there, if you joined because you were patriotic, and you wanted to fight the bad guys, the terrorists who were threatening the United States, and that's very complicated. And or you were, you were in the National Guard and you were just sent over there. You never expected that to happen in a million years. Or maybe you were you volunteered for a career in the Army because there was no other jobs in this wonderful country of ours. So what was left open to you was to go over and invade somebody's country and shoot people for no good reason, usually for a bad reason. And then you come back without a leg or demented or your brain's rattled permanently from an explosion. An IED or something like that. You can't live among regular people anymore. You don't have an arm. You don't have a leg. You're quadriplegic. You can't digest things. You can't quite do the work that you once used to do, even though you're young and strong. When you went over there, you're nothing now. And the brutality you saw and all the things that happened over there, rapes, murders of children, terrorizing innocent people. Come back here and nobody says a word about it like it never happened. And like you were never there. I don't know how that feels. There's a couple of things here about that. 10 years after the start of the U.S. invasion in Iraq, doctors in some of the Middle Eastern nations' cities are witnessing an abnormally high number of cases of cancer and birth defects. Scientists suspect that the rise is tied to the use of depleted uranium and white phosphorus in military assaults by the United States forces. On the war's 10-year anniversary, Democracy Now!, this is from Democracy Now! Website, spoke with Dar Jamail, an Al Jazeera's reporter who recently returned from Iraq. Jamail, he's been on my show, actually, on Sirius. Jamail recounts meeting Dr. Samira Alani, a doctor in the city of Fallujah, focusing on the issue of birth defects. She said it's common now in Fallujah for newborns to come out with massive multiple systemic defects, immune problems, massive central nervous system problems. These are newborns. Massive heart problems, skeletal disorders. Babies are born with two heads, babies being born without half their internal organs, et cetera, et cetera. Jamail says that the current rate of birth defects after the city of Fallujah for the city of Fallujah has surpassed those of Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the nuclear attacks at the end of World War II. Right? Also brought to you by the brave American government and its military. Echoing Jamail's findings, on September 2012, a study published in the Bulletin of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology focused on maternity hospitals in the city of Basra and Fallujah recorded a devastating number of birth defects in the past decade. The study also indicated that childhood leukemia and other types of cancers are on the rise. Let's see. As David Kenner notes in Foreign Policy, the numbers of miscarriages and birth defects are much higher than before the start of the war and also wildly out of proportion to numbers collected in the rest of the world. Mojgan Savabisfani, one of the lead authors of the 2012 study and a toxicologist at the University of Michigan, told The Independent in 2012 that there is, quote, compelling evidence to connect the growing number of defects at birth to the military assaults at Basra and Fallujah because we used weapons that were approved for use that cost tremendous amounts of money and made the weapons manufacturers rich, were approved for use by people like Donald Rumsfeld and people in the United States who had no chance of suffering from any of the use of these weapons. And now babies are born with gigantically high rates of malformed bodies and minds that don't work. And this is the 10th anniversary last week. Nothing is marked about it. I posted something on the Occupied Territory Facebook page, and it's a letter that was written by a man who is dying now. He's on the verge of death. He was interviewed by Chris Hedges, who wrote a very passionate, very moving article about him. His name is Thomas Young, and he was wounded in Iraq. Thomas Young joined the Army 2 days after September 11th, 2001, and was shot and paralyzed after serving only 5 days in Iraq in 2004. He was the subject of a powerful 2007 documentary, Body of War. That's what it's called, with a soundtrack that included Pearl Jam, Rage Against the Machine, and Bruce Springsteen. And since then, his health has worsened, and he is currently under hospice care. He's dying, and he's on the verge of death. On the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, Young wrote a personal letter to George Bush and Dick Cheney. It was originally posted on truthdig.com, yet another one of those websites I will recommend from time to time. You really should go to truthdig.com and sign up for any notifications of new articles. That's where Hedges writes and various other people. Robert Scheer, too. Do we have a show from Truthdig here? Do you know? We do. We do have a show. Do you know what date and time it is? Saturday at 7 p.m., Truthdig. It's a great website, and they have a show here in PRN. A lot of good shows here in PRN. You should check out our schedule. Thomas Young has given us permission to reprint it here, and this was on Truthdig. The last letter, it's called, to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney from Thomas Young, T-O-M-A-S. Thomas Young. I write this letter on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War on behalf of my fellow Iraq War veterans. I write this letter on behalf of the 4,488 soldiers and Marines who died in Iraq. I write this letter on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of veterans who have been wounded on behalf of those wounds, physical and psychological, have destroyed their lives. I am one of those who was gravely wounded. I was paralyzed in an insurgent ambush in 2004 in Sadr City. My life is coming to an end. I am living under hospice care. I write this letter on behalf of husbands and wives who have lost spouses, on behalf of children who have lost a parent, on behalf of the fathers and mothers who have lost sons and daughters, and on behalf of those who care for the many thousands of my fellow veterans who have brain injuries. I write this letter on behalf of those veterans whose trauma and self-revulsion for what they have witnessed, endured, and done in Iraq have led to suicide, and on behalf of the active duty soldiers and Marines who commit, on average, a suicide a day. I write this letter on behalf of some 1 million Iraqi dead, on behalf of the countless Iraq wounded. I write this letter on behalf of us all, the human detritus of your war that have been left behind, those who will spend lives in unending pain and grief. I write this letter, my last letter, to you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney. I write not because I think you grasp the terrible human and moral consequences of your lies, manipulation, and thirst for wealth and power. I write this letter because before my own death, I want to make it clear that I and hundreds of thousands of my fellow veterans, along with millions of my fellow citizens, along with hundreds of millions of more in Iraq and in the Middle East, know fully who you are and what you have done. You may evade justice, but in our eyes, you are each guilty of egregious war crimes, of plunder, and finally of murder, including the murder of thousands of young Americans, my fellow veterans, whose future you stole. Your positions of authority, your millions of dollars of personal wealth, your public relations consultants, your privilege and your power cannot mask the hollowness of your character. You sent us to fight and die in Iraq after you, Mr. Cheney, dodged the draft in Vietnam, and you, Mr. Bush, went AWOL from your National Guard unit. Your cowardice and your selfishness were established decades ago. You were not willing to risk yourselves for our nation, but you sent hundreds of thousands of young men and women to be sacrificed in a senseless war with no more thought than it takes to put out the garbage. I joined the Army 2 days after the 9/11 attacks. I joined the Army because our country had been attacked. I wanted to strike back at those who had killed some 3,000 of my fellow citizens. I did not join the Army to go to Iraq, a country that had no part in the September 2001 attacks, and did not pose a threat to its neighbors, much less to the United States. I did not join the Army to liberate Iraqis or to shut down mythical weapons of mass destruction facilities, or to implant what you cynically called democracy in Baghdad in the Middle East. I did not join the Army to rebuild Iraq, which at the time you told us could be paid for by Iraq's oil revenues. Instead, this war has cost the United States over $3 trillion. I especially did not join the Army to carry out preemptive war. Preemptive war is illegal under international law. And as a soldier in Iraq, I was, I now know, abetting your idiocy and your crimes. The Iraq War is the largest strategic blunder in U.S. history. It obliterated the balance of power in the Middle East. It installed a corrupt and brutal pro-Iranian government in Baghdad, one cemented in power through the use of torture, death squads, and terror, and it has left Iran as the dominant force in the region. On every level, moral, strategic, military, and economic, Iraq was a failure. And it was you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney, who started this war. It was you who should pay the consequences. I would not be writing this letter if I had been wounded fighting in Afghanistan against those forces that carried out the attacks of 9/11. Had I been wounded there, I could still be miserable because of my physical deterioration and imminent death, but I would at least have the comfort of knowing that my injuries were a consequence of my own decision to defend the country I love. I would not have to lie in my bed, my body filled with painkillers, my life ebbing away, and deal with the fact that hundreds of thousands of human beings, including children, including myself, were sacrificed by you for little more than the greed of oil companies, for your alliance with the oil sheiks in Saudi Arabia, and your insane visions of empire. I have, like many other disabled veterans, suffered from the inadequate and often inept care provided by the Veterans Administration. I have, like many other disabled veterans, come to realize that our mental and physical wounds are of no interest to you, perhaps of no interest to any politician. We were used, we were betrayed, and we have been abandoned. You, Mr. Bush, make much pretense of being a Christian, but isn't lying a sin? Isn't murder a sin? Aren't theft and selfish ambition sins? I am not a Christian, but I believe in the Christian ideal. I believe that what you do to the least of your brothers, you finally do to yourself, to your own soul. My day of reckoning is upon me. Yours will come. I hope you will be put on trial, but mostly I hope for your sakes that you find the moral courage to face what you have done to me and to many, many others who deserve to live. I hope that before your time on earth ends, as mine is now ending, you will find the strength of character to stand before the American public and the world, and in particular the Iraq people, and beg for forgiveness. This is from Thomas Young. If you go to Truthdig and put in T-O-M-A-S Young, you will find it, and you'll see Chris Hedge's commentary on it. 10 years last week, and we will pay for this for the rest of our lives. Financially, from murders, from suicides, and karmically for the soul, what exists of it, of this country. We'll be back after a break. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory, hosted once again by Mike Fader. We're here every Thursday at 2 p.m. And as I mentioned before, and as I frequently mention, because I want to build up this page, it's a way of people getting together, at least commiserating with each other, and maybe helping to plan the activities that could actually change our country and our government for the better. It's called Facebook. It's on Facebook. It's called Occupied Territory. The name of this show is Occupied Territory America, and you can check our archives out. We have podcasts going back now about a year and a half when we first started this show here. Also, if you're interested, I do another show on PRN.FM here on Mondays at 4 p.m., in which I talk about various things, cultural stories about my own life, which hopefully reflect universal themes, love, death, children, you know, pop culture, that kind of thing. So that's on Mondays at 4 p.m. if you'd like to listen to it. I had a guy on my show the other night, and his name is Paul Buckhite. He's an economics teacher at a university out in the Midwest. And he wrote an article about, and you heard all this stuff before. You've heard it so much, actually, you probably don't want to hear it again. But guess what? You are going to hear it again, because it's the essential issue. And I was talking to this man, a very decent fellow, right? And I'm going to read you some stuff from his article that he wrote, that posted on Alternate. And his point was, at the end, was there are so many things to be concerned about. There are so many things to be concerned about, so many issues that are vital, that concern our health, our life, our death, the planet's life and death, bigotry, racism. There's just no end to it, right? And sometimes you get overwhelmed by this. And then also, if you don't get overwhelmed, then you want to, you know what, you get like 1,000 requests on the email and the you know, in your mailbox to support this and support that. Children are starving in various places. In this country, mountaintop coal mining, you know, fracking, people are getting cancer all over the place. Like I say, there is no end of issues to be concerned about. Now, obviously, if you are concerned about one particular issue that affects you, if you're worried about, you know, about if it's gay marriage and you're gay or you have good friends or family members that are gay. In other words, anything that's personal to your life. And I'm going to make a comparison later historically to what house to the general large issues that affect us all personally. And what Mr. Buckeye was saying, and I'll read something from his article about the income inequality in this country, the harsh, horrible facts of the income inequality in this country is that his opinion is, and a lot of people's is, and one reason why this show was created is that income inequality is underneath all of this. The overwhelming cancerous growth of greed in the American soul and the American body and the body politic in our culture has overtaken everything else. Income inequality is greater now in this country than it perhaps has ever been, even in our crazy Gilded Age when there were no laws controlling anybody. And it's extraordinary, and it damages every part of our lives in this country. It damages our political system, our very health, how long we live, the way we live, what we suffer from, what our neighbors suffered from, what the world has to suffer. Income inequality is at the bottom of all of this. The rich and the poor, the rich and the rest of us. And that's what the 1% and the 99%. That's what this show is here for, to talk about and to help activate people to change it. To change this income imbalance. And what he suggested, Paul Buckeyt, who I'm going to read his article in a minute, is that even though there are issues which are a vital concern to different groups of people, he thinks that we should all, in addition to being active on those issues, nobody's saying to stop being active on those issues, he thinks that we should all get together and focus as much energy as possible on the one single issue so that we can actually change everything. It would be like if there was some huge, gigantic, complicated machine where all sorts of parts were going awry and, you know, smoke was coming out of it and things were grinding to a halt on one part of it. Other parts of it was too speeded up. Other parts were slowed down. It wasn't working right in its various components. But if you looked at it long enough, you'd find that the basic problem at the base of the machine was something that controlled all the rest of the breakdown. Here in this country now, it's income inequality. This is the root of most of the evil in this country. Even the bigotry, even the intolerance, even the craziness about guns, you name it, all of this stuff can be traced back to the fact that 95% of the people in this country are kept wanting, and sometimes very wanting, while a handful of people have something like 50, 60, 70% of the total land, money, and wealth in this country. It's wrong. It's evil, if anything ever was. And it's the cause of so much trouble. And it just gets worse because their control keeps being cemented. And the government is really just a tool for corporations. That's what it's all about. So his suggestion is to focus on the one thing. And I'm going to go a little bit later and talk about the history of this kind of thing and how, why it is important to focus on one, maybe two issues, but on one in particular. Otherwise, nothing could really get achieved. It's too fragmented. Here's a little article that came from a website I check out once in a while called Too Much. You might want to look at this. It's called T-O-O, Much, Too Much. Ford chief executive Alan Mulally. He has restored Ford to profitability. His many business and political admirers never tire of pointing out without having to take any taxpayer bailout. But Mulally has indeed enjoyed a hefty bailout from his own workers at Ford. Entry-level workers at Ford used to make $28 an hour. That is not a lot of money these days, right? That rate fell by half when the auto industry financial crunch first hit 5 years ago, and now sits above $19. And since the crunch, all Ford workers, not just entry-level workers, have given up cost-of-living wage adjustments and health benefits. Auto industry executives have declared these worker concessions as absolutely necessary. Without lower compensation for auto workers, the argument goes, the auto industry would never become globally competitive. This same reasoning apparently doesn't apply to compensation for Ford CEO Alan Mulally. Ford has just announced that Mulally's pay package for 2012 nearly hit $21 million. His personal rewards for the year almost doubled the pay that went last year to his chief German rival, Daimler CEO Dieter Zetsche. and even more stunningly dwarfed the 1.4 million Toyota CEO Akio Toyoda took home. But the magnitude of how well Bilyeu has done for himself since Ford workers started coughing up concessions only swings into real focus when we step back and contemplate the towering pile of Ford shares of stock he now holds. In just over a half dozen years, CNN Money reports Mullally has amassed holdings valued at $300 million. So he has presided over a company where the wages have been cut practically in half, if you take into account the giving up of the cost of living wage adjustments and health benefits. He himself gets $21 million, while a worker who makes the cars gets $19 an hour. This is just one of many examples, many of which you've heard before. This is from Paul Buchheit's article. The first step is to learn the facts, then get angry, and to ask ourselves, as progressives and caring human beings, what we can do about the relentless transfer of wealth to a small group of well-positioned Americans. Each of the Koch brothers saw his investments grow by $6 billion in 1 year, which is $3 million per hour based on a 40-hour week. $3 million per hour based on a 40-hour week, and they don't make anything. They don't help anybody. They don't make so much as a screwdriver, and they don't provide so much as directions to the local grocery store for anybody. They are leeches and parasites in the face of the earth. The current federal minimum wage, by the way, the person, for instance, who mops a floor in a restaurant or stacks fruit and vegetables in a grocery store or stands security at a construction site for 8 hours, makes $7.25 an hour. The minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. The Koch brothers, doing nothing at all last year, made $3 million an hour. Their income portrays them in a society measured by economic status as a million times more valuable than the restaurant server who cheers up our lunch hours while hoping to make enough on tips to pay the bills. A comparison of top and bottom salaries within large corporations is much less severe, but a lot more common. For CEOs and minimum wage workers, the difference is $5,000 per hour versus $7.25 per hour. A single top income could buy housing for every homeless person in the U.S. And I want you to listen to this one. This is one that really is something. On a winter day, a cold winter day, when a lot of people can freeze to death and don't have heat in their houses or hardly even live in houses in some cases, on a winter day in 2012, over 633,000 people were homeless in the United States. Based on an annual single-room occupancy cost of $558 per month, any one of the 10 richest Americans would have enough with his 2012 income to pay for a room for every homeless person in the U.S. for the entire year. Any one of the 10 richest people in this country would have enough with his 2012 income to pay for a room for every homeless person in the U.S. for the entire year. For anyone still believing that, quote, they earned it, unquote, it should be noted that most of the Forbes 400 earnings came from minimally taxed, non-job-creating capital gains. And I would add to that, where, again, people did nothing, made nothing, helped no one. What is there to do about this, asks Mr. Buchheit here. End the capital gains giveaway, which benefits the wealthy almost exclusively. Institute a financial speculation tax, both to raise needed funds from a currently untaxed subsidy on stock purchases and to reduce the risk of irresponsible trading that nearly brought down the economy. But perhaps, above all, we progressives have to choose one strategy and pursue it in a cohesive, unrelenting attack on greed. Only this will heal the ugly gash of inequality that has split our country in two. And I will add, this is not going to happen by voting for the two corporate political parties. It is not going to happen by voting for anybody in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. It will not. You can try to change them from within if you want with primary victories for real liberal candidates, the way the Tea Party did. They've crippled the political process and the Republican Party. But we could do that. We could mount primary campaigns. And I know a lot of you are still devoted to the idea of electoral politics. Good luck to you. But where will the money come, you have to ask, to finance all these primary challenges? The people in the Tea Party were, that was a AstroTurf movement, not a real grassroots movement. The people in the Tea Party who basically defeated a lot of regular Republicans in the primary and pulled the party even further off to the crazy right, they were funded by people like the Koch brothers. In other words, hundreds of millions of dollars was poured in from various rich people and corporations, because thanks to the Supreme Court, with no accounting for it, to run, professional primary campaigns and ad campaigns against regular Republican candidates. That's how they took over the Tea Party. That's how they sucked the life out of the Republican Party. Theoretically, the same thing could be done on the left, that that truly liberal or real left candidates, people who pay attention to what people want, not corporations, you know, they could run in the primaries and defeat regular corporate-controlled Democrats. But where's the money coming for that? Now, having said, let me check. Well, how much time do we have, Matt? How much time we got left there? 20 minutes. Okay. Having said that, as I mentioned, this show, Occupied Territory, was instituted right after the first occupations of Zuccotti Park down in New York City in October of 2011. And the point of the Occupied Territory movement and its major point that they wanted to make, and for which a lot of people paid a lot of dues and changed, according to the newspaper, the media, it changed the dialogue in this country. Bullshit. It changed the dialogue, really? Because the president of the United States, this whorish, mass-murdering corporate tool, said a few times, quote-unquote, yes, rich folks should pay a little more money. And he was right about it in the end. He finally came up with a budget where rich folks did pay a little more money. And you know they're never going to pay the extra tax anyhow. They have accountants that make more money in one day than you make in a whole year. And they're going to see to it that whatever the tax rise is, they're not going to pay it. So this son of a bitch president, along with every son of a bitch people, a person in his party at the highest level, they're not doing anything. They're not doing you any favors. So basically what happened is the Occupy movement is pointing out and has been pointed out many times in history before, and not just pointed out, but actually acted upon, that nothing really important, almost nothing really important, with one or two exceptions, has ever been achieved in this country without the threat of stopping everything dead in its tracks, without massive civil disobedience, protests running into the hundreds of thousands and millions on a relentless basis, just throwing a monkey wrench into the gears of the machine and stopping it dead until we can rebuild the machine the right way, or until the people who sort of own and run the machines, with our help, with our work, start to operate them in a way which benefits us as well as them. And we've all seen this over and over again a million times. We've seen it a million times. And it's important to think about what this man said in this article. There have been times in this country where various issues were paramount and they were stark and they involved life and death. It's difficult. When you go over history, you see that nothing really was ever achieved, even in the most liberal or civilized of democracies, without mass opinion and mass protest, most of it often illegal, on the outside, pressuring political parties, even the ones that are presumed to be or are supposed to be in favor more of people's rights, right, than the rich. Although I don't know where that party is anymore. We don't really have a party like that. We have a third party like that. We have the Justice Party, Rocky Anderson. We have Jill Stein, the Green Party. We have third parties that are truly in favor of common people's rights. That is to say, you know, 99% of the population. But really, the political process, you don't want to throw it out in the trash. You can't do that because you have anarchy and it's totally uncivilized. You wind up with a place like Putin's Russia, where it's basically gangland. That's just a mafia organization where various gangs fight it out. And one guy is the Capo di Capo, and that's Putin. He's the head mafia guy at the head of the biggest mafia family in Russia. And he tells the other mafia guys what they can do. They're otherwise known as the Russian government, the Russian parliament, and Russian corporations. It's just a big mafia operation. Or it'll turn into, the most violent, vicious kind of example of the Wild West in this country, where drunken, psychopathic murderers, both in uniform and out, went out west in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and just stole things from everybody, murdered people, raped people, took whatever they wanted, and there was no law there. That's what a lot of people, I think, seem to want. People who claim that Americans should be individuals and carry guns to stand up for their rights as Americans, as if they understand one damn thing they're talking about. But we don't want anarchy. There is a value to having some. Obviously, you need some sort of civilized, nonviolent way to move a country in the right direction to protect the mass of its citizens. If we went by the Constitution of this country, if we went by the Declaration of Independence, then that's what we would be doing. But those were always ideals, you know? Those were always ideals that we were supposed to live up to. And who has ever really lived up to the ideals of the founders of any country or revolution, including Russia, including France and this country, other revolutions in various places, Haiti in 1803, 1804. Who has ever really lived up to that kind of thing? I don't know. Hardly anybody. But people strive to do it. That's what those documents are there for. The Declaration of Independence is something to strive for. And it says, you know, all men should be all men and women, you know, if you want to be clear about it. But all people are created equal, endowed with their creator, etc. It's a beautiful moving document, and it was rarely fulfilled. In fact, if you go look at the original founders and throughout the history of this country, there are times in history where things become so bad in a society for various reasons, in certain particular ways, that it makes it easy to change things. Ironically, in a kind of ironic way, makes it easy. I came up in the 60s, and there was always income inequality in this country, but far less of it than there is now. Actually, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. In the 50s, it was the height of the success of the union movement. Yeah, like I've mentioned many times before, so no need to go into it in detail again. A lot of unions got carried away with themselves. And there was feather bedding. Look it up. You know, the people pretending to work when they didn't, other people clocking people in who weren't working, people getting kickbacks from other people who claimed they were helping claim they were working, but they weren't. Wages and salaries went so high in some cases that it made it difficult for almost any profit to be made by any business. And so that's something that had to be adjusted a little bit. But still, the corporations and the CEOs and the shareholders could afford a little bit more so that a regular worker could buy a house, could buy a car, could send their kids to college, and without worrying about it, without being in debt their whole lives, without struggling to even make ends meet every minute like now. And kids didn't graduate from college in those days with mountains of debt. We just didn't. Things didn't cost as much. People weren't making as much. There wasn't as much profit and greed. It just wasn't the ethic and the ethos of the country. So this is when I grew up. Then comes the Vietnam War, and then the great massive movement for civil rights, finally, in this country. You know, we end slavery during the Civil War, pass various amendments to end slavery and to try to equalize relationships between people. It wouldn't happen. It didn't happen in reality, although slavery did end. But, you know, you see the prejudice and the lynchings, the forbidding people from even voting, separate bathrooms, separate lunch counters, separate places on buses, treating people like animals, treating people like second-class citizens, fifth-class citizens, ruining people's lives, instilling in their minds a kind of sense of inferiority and contempt for themselves that comes from above, from people who are no better than animals, right? And so this thing is still happening all the time. We have the inheritance of this slavery and racism in this country. So what happened in the 60s is we had the civil rights movement. We had the war in Vietnam where people were drafted to go and kill people 10,000 miles away in a place that we had no business being, again, like in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. No business being whatsoever, especially I mentioned Iraq. And, you know, they drafted people. So it was your life or your death, that war. And it made it very easy. It crystallized things. It focused things so that you knew exactly what you wanted and what you didn't want and what had to be done. We needed to stop the war. We needed to stop the war. There were plenty of other issues. Women were still treated as second and third class citizens. Stay in the home and shut up. You know, you could work here 10 years, you don't get a raise, but every guy around you does, et cetera, et cetera. Rapes, you know, and we see, you know, what's going on now with that. you know, the oppression of gay people. All these things started popping up in the 60s and 70s, a kind of liberation, use of relatively harmless drugs, i.e., you know, marijuana, that kind of thing. There were revolts in various places that started in the late 60s and early 70s in various gay communities, right, and among the gay community activists. And then women's rights starting in the 60s and then the 70s. But the main thing was the Vietnam War. This war was draining money out of this country. It was taking away everybody's ability to make a living, except for weapons manufacturers and other people like that who were in those industries. It was taking money out of our treasury. It was causing people to lose jobs in, you know, in essential government services. It was causing a civil war in the middle of this country. It was ruining everything, and people's lives were being lost. What was it, 60,000 American soldiers were killed in Vietnam, and hundreds of thousands of them came back damaged beyond repair in their minds and their bodies. And what did we do? We killed over 2 million people in Vietnam, and people are dying to this day from Agent Orange. What happened in Iraq is probably dwarfed of what happened in Vietnam. Tens of thousands of rapes, plain slaughter and murder just for the hell of it over there. Read Nick Turse's book. Called Nick Turse, T-U-R-S-E, called Kill Anything That Moves, if you want to know what really happened in Vietnam. If you could stand to read it, it's really horrible. So we had Vietnam, and we had the civil rights movement. Clearly, what was happening to people. And so we crystallized this. Despite all the other things that were happening, income inequality, oppression of different classes of people, the two things that stood out clearly that involved life and death and treating other people as if they didn't belong to the human race were the Vietnam War and stopping that, and civil rights and restoring them or giving them, even in the first place, a decent chance to live a decent life to black people in this country. And we focused on that stuff, and we achieved a tremendous amount by doing that. And how did we achieve it? We achieved it by going around the political system. There is no way to right massive wrongs like that that involve life and death or tremendous generations of racism. There is no way to correct gigantic, massive oppression and wrong in a country by going through a political party. In the end, the political parties will be pulled to where they have to go, to an area, to a zone of human decency, by people stepping outside the law and outside the political parties. You can see this throughout world history. Some places needed a revolution. In Russia, people had to actually overthrow a government, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were tortured and killed in the process of doing that, overthrowing a feudal state. In France, in 1789, people had to rise up and sacrifice their lives to overthrow an aristocracy that treated people as if they weren't even as human as an ant, you know, or human as an ant. They weren't even at the level of an ant or a roach. These people in the aristocracy in France behaved in a manner which is incomprehensible to most people now. Except possibly if you're the Koch brothers or if you're running the U.S. government. I don't really know. But revolutions had to happen in places or nothing would ever change. I saw, because I was, you know, trying to seek some rest from reading books and writing articles yesterday, I was watching some TV. It's kind of like a sedative for me late at night before I go to bed. I'm watching this really bad version of Robin Hood with Russell Crowe. Really bad. You know, this big, tubby old guy running around the woods, you know. And the whole movie was just this murky, churning piece of junk. But and forget about history being accurate in these movies. One of the commanding, you know, themes of the movie, if not the commanding theme of the movie, except for basically, you know, swords and arrows, was that the king was a tyrant and that the people should rise up against him. Well, of course, that's entirely a delusional bullshit when it comes to history. The people in England did not rise up against anybody. What happened was that the barons got pissed off because the king was taking too much of their own land. It wasn't enough for them to have, you know, they had already 6 castles and 5 billion acres each, and they treated people like scum and like slaves. And no need to go into the details. But they were upset because the king was taking more of what they had. So it was the barons who rose up. the feudal aristocracy that rose up against the king there. And they summoned the people to stand up for England against the king. It wasn't England. It was the Koch brothers' fifth mansion, you know, against the king. So, but in every area, especially even in civilized places, structured democracies, places where democracy is a living, breathing thing, like this country, no political party, including Roosevelt's Democratic Party of the 1930s, that did more to help the average human being and to set into place protections for the average human being in this country that tried to make the playing field as level as possible so that the rich weren't marauding every second and taking everything away from all of us, making our lives miserable and plunging us into ruin and misery, as they do constantly, as you can see now in this country and all over the world. What happened was Roosevelt's party had to do that because we were on the verge of a revolution in this country in the 1930s. There were millions and millions of people, and if you adjust for the numbers of the population in the country, there was approximately, it was roughly almost a third of the population now. I mean, that's how big the population has gotten and how fast. There were something like 126 million Americans in 1932. Now there's 320 million Americans. So if you use today's figures, it would be like tens of millions of people without a place to live or something to eat. It's not quite that bad here, but it's bad enough. And the income inequality now between a worker and between a corporate CEO, between people, there's something like 10 people in this country that own 50-60% of all the money and all the wealth and all the stocks and bonds in the whole country. They own as much. 10 people own as much as something like 150 million other people in this country. It can't be that way and have a democracy. It can't be that way and have a decent life and a culture and an everyday life you wake up in and want to live in. It can't work. It can't work. But nothing has ever been changed. Now, look what happened in India with Gandhi in the 1930s and 40s. Now, there was, a British colonial, administration that was imposed by rule of force, you know, the army and the local Indian militia that they controlled. And who understands people who live in a country whose brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers are being murdered and oppressed and kept in poverty by a foreign power, another race, another religion that comes to their country? Who could ever understand these people who join the army and the police and beat and shoot their own people for the benefit of lords and masters from over the ocean someplace? This is something I could never understand. And yet it happens in every country. It happens in our country. The militarized police, you know, the FBI, people who operate against their own people, their own family, their own country, their own sense of democracy for the benefit of their lords and masters who are rich. There'll always be authoritarian personalities like this. They get off on hitting people, locking people up, keeping people down. It makes them feel better. They must be very, very disturbed in their minds, these people. But nothing has ever happened, especially even in a democracy, without some sort of disobeying the law. You cannot just keep going like sheep every 2 years or every 4 years to the polls to vote for whatever jerk off and con man tells you he's going to help you out. They won't. They don't. They don't give a shit about you. They don't care. Get it? They don't care. Now, I know you all get it. I'm just getting carried away here. Maybe somebody will hear me who isn't used to hearing me, because the people in this audience generally agree with me. I know I'm preaching to the converted already. But you get carried away by this stuff. Don't bother with it anymore. If you can get the money to defeat these corporate Democrats in a primary, good luck to you. I hope it works. But I don't believe it will. The only thing that happened in the 60s to stop a war and to get civil rights for people was that people put their bodies on the line and got beat up, sometimes got killed. Churches were burned down. Churches were bombed down south. People were shot to death by the police. The FBI and the CIA, though they weren't supposed to. Look at Homeland. Homeland is hysterical. My wife and I were watching Homeland on TV. It's all about the CIA operating in the United States and all the things they do to spy on people. Did you know, just for your own personal interest, although I'm sure most of you already know this, the CIA is forbidden by federal law to operate within the domestic boundaries of the United States? So much for Homeland, and so much for your rights and mine. What I'm saying is, income inequality, we have to focus on that. Nobody will ever have a decent life. You, your children, your wife, your husband, your relatives, your colleagues, your friends, and your neighbors in your building, on your block, in your neighborhood, in your town. No one in this country will ever have a decent life. Our democracy will become more and more perverted, more militaristic. More billions of dollars will be spent on policing our own country. Do you know the Department of Homeland Security purchased over the last year or two 1.6 billion rounds of ammunition, a lot of it hollow point ammunition? Did you know that? This is from Forbes magazine. This is not from Left Wing Revolutionary magazine. Why does the Department of Homeland Security need 1.6 billion rounds of high-grade military ammunition? I don't know. Figure it out yourself. I'm saying this. Without Gandhi, without people hitting the streets in the 30s, the Communist Party and other people, without people in Germany in the 1920s and 30s hitting the streets, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, without revolutions in Russia and France, without us getting out on the street and getting our heads beat in and locked up and arrested in the 60s, there would be no progress, no human evolution of rights and benefits in our democracy. It never would have happened. You can't stay within the law and change things for the better. You cannot do it. Because the law is written by people who don't care about you. They own it. They own the law. It's their property. It's not your law. It's their law. You got to step outside. Bob Dylan has a line in his song which says, to live outside the law, you must be honest. That's the truth. That is the truth.